Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS makes its annual budget request to Mecklenburg County. To be frank, it's a whopper. We will fill you in. How Charlotte uses the money collected from the hospitality or tourist tax has been a point of discussion for about a week, but the pushback indicates no changes will be coming. Mark Robinson, North Carolina's controversial lieutenant governor running for the top job, may have personal money issues, a spate of school bus accidents, an eclipse, and a big, big, big win for the Gamecocks women's basketball team and for women's basketball in general. We'll talk about it all with Ann Doss Helm. She's WFAE's education reporter. She is here along with Mary Ramsey, a local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning. Welcome, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Yesterday, Mary, it was announced that the Arts and Science Council and the Foundation for the Carolinas are exploring ways to join forces to secure more funding for the arts and cultural community. This came out of the clear blue sky for me. Did it for you? You reported on this.
So ever since the pandemic, which came shortly after Mecklenburg County voters elected to not take on a sales and tax increase to help fund the arts, there's been a lot of uncertainty in the arts community about funding. The city pulled a lot of the money it traditionally was giving to the Arts and Science Council for grants and said, we're going to come up with our own new council. We're going to distribute this money ourselves. The county elected to stick with the ASC, which created a bit of a divide. The pandemic created a lot of uncertainty for major arts venues when they had to shutter due to quarantine. So, you know, in some ways, this has been in motion for a while. That being said, this is a new idea, the idea that the Foundation from the Carolinas, of course, a major nonprofit in the region, would team up with the ASC to basically create a whole new leadership structure, a whole new board of directors, some appointed by the city, some appointed by the county, some picked by those two groups. And the big thing, wanting $21 million annually and a 5 to 10 year commitment from both the city and the county.
For newcomers who don't know anything about this, we should point out the Arts and Science Council, the ASC, was for years one of the most successful arts fundraisers in the country. And their business model was very much like the United Way. They would collect from you at work. That business model stopped working. People stopped giving at work. And no matter what you think of the ASC, and there are people on both sides of that equation, they were the biggest supporter monetarily of local arts in Charlotte. And then when the city pulled the plug and decided to go their own way, that left the county funding the Arts and Science Council exclusively. And George Dunlap, you quote him in your story, Mary, saying that's a lot of local arts groups lost out when that happened. I'm curious what happened to the city's effort. I've heard nothing about it since they appointed a director and set up an organization to fund the arts.
So the city was working after that process to come up with their own arts and culture plan. That plan was debuted to city council back in October and approved in November. It called for a number of things, including increased investment in the arts with a special focus on formerly marginalized communities, as well as supporting traditional venues that are city-owned or partially city-owned. But the thing about that plan was really was very light on details about how the city was going to pay for all this.
And remains so.
Yes. And now you've got the ASC saying, well, we want to team up with the Foundation from the Carolinas. We want $11 million from the city annually, as well as $10 million annually from the county to make our plan happen. And now the city told me that they were not involved in those discussions, that they are continuing to work on how to fund their plan and are not yet fully committed to what the ASC is proposing.
I find, yeah, it's interesting. I want to know which one of these organizations is driving this. Is it the Foundation or is it the Arts and Science Council that's driving this move to try to put their combined forces? Do you know?
So it was the ASC that brought forward a presentation on this to County Commission this week. However, the Foundation for the Carolinas will have quite a bit of oversight. The ASC would sort of be working within their structure. The foundation would appoint multiple members to the new board of directors for the new ASC and would have final approval over all of the directors appointed by everybody else, the city, the county, and the ASC. And that level of oversight was something that worried some county commissioners.
But I know Eric wants to get into this, but if the city has its own organization, even though it's relatively opaque about exactly what it's doing and how it's working and how much money is going where and to whom and how it all comes together, if you're going to ask the city for $11 million and you're going to ask the county for 10, which adds up to 21, why didn't you involve the city in these discussions?
You ask a very good question. That is not something during the presentation to county commissioners. The ASC board chair said that their plan fits within the vision of the city's plan, but didn't go further than that. And as I said, the city told me they have not been involved in discussions with the ASC and the foundation about this plan, and they're not committed to chipping in anything as of yet.
Eric?
I mean, let's remember, we're coming to the end of a three-year transition that was spearheaded by the city and the Foundation for the Carolinas to come up with a new governing structure, a new funding structure. In the meantime, they had secured all this money from both the private sector and the public sector to have more funding for the groups in the meantime. And so this is, I guess, not the best result, not the ultimate outcome they probably wanted when they started 3 years ago. And now here they are coming up on July 1st, which is the start of a new fiscal year when they need that new funding to be in place and that new structure. And everything's kind of up in the air at the moment. So that is a bit of a head scratcher, I guess.
I had forgotten that the ASC was involved in this plan that the city is involved in terms of they're taking the arts funding onto their own shoulders. What does it say that the Foundation for the Carolinas, which helped set that up, is helping to set this up and is expecting to help go to the city and ask them for $11 million. Is that a condemnation of the city's plan?
I don't know. I think what it tells us really is that nobody has hit upon an idea that has obviously generated consensus, and they realize that they're in a scramble now and they've got to figure something out fast. Because as I said, July 1st, I mean, all these museums, arts groups, they're all counting on their next round of grants. There's got to be a system and funding in place. And right now, they don't know which way they're going.
So, Mary, where does all this stand?
Well, we'll see what if County Commission chooses to bite. I know Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell seemed very on board with the plan after the presentation. Chairman Dunlap made some comments that seemed like he was in agreement. But you also had multiple commissioners expressing some concern about just how much oversight the foundation would have over this new structure and whether the county government should have more. Commissioner Arthur Griffin also brought up that he still has serious concerns about whether there's enough funding in this plan for diversity and equity in the arts to support not just the more traditional venues here in Charlotte, but also artists and organizations from marginalized communities. So we'll see if they take it, but remains to be seen.
Well, we'll keep our eye on that. Let's move on to other money matters. The annual budget request that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools makes of Mecklenburg County, they are in the beginning phases of hammering that request out again this year. CMS usually asks for a lot, and this early draft is no exception. And what is the bottom line figure?
Well, it's interesting because they made a presentation in which they said the bottom line figure is we're asking for $35 million, which is a little less than last year, and they approved it last year. But if you really look at their budget, that operating increase is really $63.5 million, which is about a 10% increase. So that's bigger than usual. It's had this sort of
hold on. I had the bottom line at $691.9 million.
Oh, for the total. That sounds
total,
right.
Yeah.
I was talking increases. Yes.
Okay.
So the total. Okay. And there's capital and there's operating. And so capital is usually separated out, and there's kind of a fixed amount to keep doing things to upgrade buildings, but they're also asking for a very hefty increase in that. And people tend to say, well, right, that's the 30 bond projects, right? And it's like, no, this is the 30 next 30 lower projects that need you know, this is not just like little repairs like a broken window. This is a new roof, a new HVAC system. So, and then CMS is saying, look, we got all these buildings and, you know, it takes a long time to get bond funding. We need some work on these. You can't let an HVAC system ride for
Right.
5 years.
In a letter posted with the budget, School Board Chair Stephanie Seed said the increase is needed to, quote, maintain our current level of service while also supporting student growth, new schools, employee investment, aka raises, and cyber defense. Talk about growth.
Welcome.
Has there been that much
Congratulations,
growth in
William
the school
and Rebecca.
population
And how about
in.
something to put a smile on your face?
There has not
I'm
been
not
a
sure where that's
huge
coming from.
bonus
Hold on a
increase.
second.
The next raise
I'm
will
not
be
sure where that audio
understand.
is coming
It's
from. But
quality
anyway,
care at a price.
how much growth has there been, and will there be significant growth in the future given opportunity scholarships that are going to seem to be exploding?
They're projecting, I think they said 200 to 300 students more, which is essentially flat, and it's what it's been for the last several years. You'll remember there was for a while explosive growth, and then it leveled off, and this is everywhere. This is demographic trends. Then we had the pandemic. Zoom, everybody dropped down because of, you know, remote school. And it's built up a little, but it hasn't come back to those previous levels. And it's just been pretty flat. The growth has been in charter schools, and that's again what they're projecting is that an additional $4 million, not a total of $4 million, but an additional $4 million will have to be passed on to additional students in charter schools. So they're not talking about a huge amount of growth. They are opening two new schools, and the state pays for most of the teachers and things like that. But they're saying there is certainly some money for custodial staff that's paid for out of county dollars, and costs just go up. You know, it's going to cost more to keep the lights on and to that there's, you know, 3% raises built into the budget. That adds up when you've got about 20,000 employees. So yeah, there are rising costs to, if nothing changed, it would go up.
And CMS Chief Financial Officer Kelly Klutz makes the point that they are asking for less than they did last year, about $40 million less than county commissioners actually granted them last year.
When you think about a one-time request, I would just ask you to think about money that you have in your savings account. So if you have money in your savings account, you can do something one time. You can take that big trip, you can enjoy yourself, but you're not going to take a second trip.
What did she mean by one-time request?
I found this puzzling, and they didn't do any kind of pre-brief for reporters like some superintendents have in the past. They didn't answer my questions afterward. But what they were saying was that, well, the $35.5 million or the $35 million is ongoing, you know, salaries, raises. And this additional money that brought it to $63.5 million increase was what they were calling one time, but it isn't like a one-time trip. It was things that are ongoing, like,
Yeah,
for
multi-year
instance,
projects.
yeah. So I don't quite get this idea. Like, for instance, one of them was significant money to make sure every student has a laptop or tablet to take home. And they're saying this is a 4-year project at $16 million a year. They're only asking for 8, so it's going to be more than 4 years. And kind of by definition, laptops that you're sending home with kids don't last forever. You're always going to be cycling through and replacing. Another one was part of this hourly, the raises for hourly employees, which is something that I think most people agree is really needed. And they want to bring the county commissioners. That was one point where, when they had a joint meeting, the county commissioners kind of pushed back on the school board and said, you're not asking for enough. These guys need to be at least $20. And they were talking about bringing it up to like 18 an hour or something and saying, we just can't do it that fast. So they've carved off a one-time bonus. And so that's a one-time expense. But then they also, in the same breath, said, next year we're going to come back and ask you to roll that into the hourly pay. So it's a very confusing, to me, accounting device.
CMS usually asks the county for more than they receive. It's kind of a pas de deux that they do with each other every year. It's kind of the normal way you negotiate. But you spoke with Dina DiIorio, the county manager, about this request, and she says it's different. And we'll find out why she says it's different when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Andos Helms is here, our education reporter at WFAE News. Ben Thompson is host of Flashpoint and morning anchor at WCNC-TV. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal when he has time, when he's not doing this program. And Mary Ramsey is a local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We were talking about this, the impending budget request that CMS makes of the county every year. They're in the very early stages of setting this up, and this request evidently is less than they've asked for before. And this time you spoke, Anne, with Dina DiOrio, who is Mecklenburg County Manager. She says this request is different from the CMS normal ask.
You know, as a general rule, you know, CMS has not really asked for a lot of one-time money. So I think this is just different because they never asked for that before. But some of the items, like the, you know, facility assessment items, I mean, we would consider that sort of one time. Like, we have our capital reserve and we would categorize this the same way. So it's not all that different, but we have to sort of dig deeper on some of those items to see whether or not we would consider them recurring or one time.
Because some of this money is for building repairs and for replacing or repairing HVAC systems. Some is for teacher raises. Some is to pay for, as you said, for buying laptops or tablets that kids can take home from school with them. But what about the bond referendum we just voted on? The largest bond issue in the history of the state. Is this in addition to that? I mean, what does that pay for?
The bonds, kind of once they get passed, that gets baked into the county's budget because, again, remember that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools does not have taxing authority, so the county has to borrow the money and pay it back. So that's already baked in. I believe they raised taxes 1 cent during the current year and expect another 1 cent. They said this is a big borrow, and there was going to be some property tax increase associated with that. So all of this is on top of that. And you keep saying it's less than they asked for, but I'm not convinced that that's true. That is only true if you forget about all the one-time things. And that's, the county's got to pay for that. So, you know, I this is a significantly larger total request than when they met in February and had their very preliminary. And Dina DiOrio was quick to say she's not panicking over this. She's not going to say whether it would require a tax increase. But at the time she said, well, we got about $36 million in growth to work with. So if CMS gets all of that or more than all of that, then either they've got to increase property taxes even more or really cut other services, which is not popular.
And I keep saying it's less than they normally ask for because I only know what I hear on the radio. And I said it on the radio, so I heard it on the radio. Every year we ask
they for... want you to have that message. It's been a strange presentation.
Every year we ask whether these requests are realistic, considering all of the other obligations the county faces in terms of funding. And here's what County Manager Dina DiOrio had to say about that.
I think it represents what, you know, what they believe that they need. I don't see anything... there's nothing that strikes me about it that doesn't reflect a real need of CMS. So from that perspective, I think it's pretty solid.
But you say a request like this, if granted, will almost certainly lead to the county needing to raise property taxes. Didn't they just do that?
Yeah, they just had the revaluation. And this is the real tension. You know, you have, I think in general, the voters in Mecklenburg County really support doing things for public schools, raising teacher pay, raising hourly wages, and they really hate property tax increases. So that dance that you referred to, I won't try the French term, but I think there is always that thing that the school board feels like we are obligated to say this is what we need. And then it's the county's job to say this is what we can afford. And that's where it always gets tough.
Okay. This is just part of the start of these discussions, and the school board is scheduled to hold public hearings on this on April 23rd and vote on it at a special meeting on April 30th, and the final request will be submitted to the county in May. We'll be talking about this for days. We're going
to
come back to...
Right?
Pas de deux. Or in English, pass the ducks. That's what it looks like. we'll come back.
See, that's probably what I would have said.
We'll come back to the schools in a bit. First, let's get some more on what became a hot topic in this town for about a week and a half, using our hospitality tax dollars for something other than tourist-related projects. Those taxes are levied on restaurant meals and drinks, hotel and motel rooms, rental cars, and more, and they're used to fund the convention center and upgrades to Bank of America Stadium and Spectrum Arena that supports the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And last week, Charlotte City Council member Renee Johnson floated the idea of using those tax dollars for other needs. The pushback was immediate. What happened, Eric?
Well, as you said, Mike, there was a transportation committee meeting where they were talking about a $1 billion deficit for infrastructure projects. And toward the end of that, Renee Johnson said, look, we clearly have money coming from tourism taxes. We just approved $275 million for the Hornets Arena and Practice Center. Why don't we take some of that money and put it toward some of these projects? And then Victoria Watlington and Lawana Mayfield also showed some interest. Ed Driggs at one point sounded interested in exploring this. The problem with this idea is that these taxes are mandated to be spent on tourism projects. And the wrinkle here is that in Asheville, Buncombe County, they have used some of that money for greenways and have more recently talked about using it for worker housing. And then there is a court case in Currituck County over using this kind of money for public services that was ruled in favor of sticking to tourism. So I know that's a lot, but the gist of it, Mike, is that there's really no way for that money to be used for anything other than tourism projects.
We had several members of City Council on the program on Monday, among them Malcolm Graham, who said at that initial meeting where Renee Johnson floated the idea that it was a terrible idea, something that he reiterated on this program on Monday. And Councilman Ed Driggs, who you referred to, who initially said it was an idea that was worth having conversations about, clarified that on this program on Monday. He too thinks it is a bad idea.
It is not something we want to do. State law doesn't allow it. We don't want to get into a conversation with legislators about trying to get them to allow it. And the circumstances in Asheville have been misrepresented anyway, in terms of the comparability, that Charlotte is just a very different place. We have huge needs in that hospitality arena that are being met from those taxes. And it's just fine the way it is.
He mentioned Asheville. In Asheville, they have taken this money and used it for other purposes. And the mayor of Asheville is an attorney who says the law is interpretable. You can interpret it in certain ways. She may be wrong about that because you also referenced Currituck County. Several members of the tourist industry here locally and at the state level came out almost immediately against this idea. Vinay Patel of the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority promised that he would be the first in line in Raleigh to lobby against having the tax repealed if Charlotte decided to use it for other purposes. And at the state level, a tourist industry spokesperson pointed to the lawsuits that resulted from this happening in Currituck County, where the county is now on the hook for $14 million to reimburse the money they took from that fund. And that concerned Council's Dimple Ajmera, who told us this on Monday.
Look, there has been a legal challenge, and we have to be very careful. We have a responsibility to use public dollars very wisely. We should be very careful in the decisions we make. It may sound really well, yeah, let's use this pot of money, but what are the legal challenges?
Ben, you spoke to Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles for Sunday's Flashpoint on WCNC. She had already written a letter in which she said that just because people are talking about this doesn't mean the policy will change.
Yeah, she came out pretty strongly suggesting that, almost excusing her colleagues on council for what she clearly thought were misguided attempts to talk about transit and paying for transit, and said, once you make a commitment like something to this, to people in this industry, it's a commitment that you've got to keep. And said that the people on council who suggested this had their heart in the right place, that they were thinking about what was best for Charlotte and transit without necessarily thinking about what was best and our commitments to the hospitality industry here in the city.
She should be in the diplomatic corps. Eric?
Right.
Yeah, do you hear the keep pounding drum in the background of this whole conversation? Because, of course, The tax that was extended on restaurant meals and bar tabs last legislative session is being eyed for the hundreds of millions of dollars that are likely going to be committed to a major renovation of Bank of America Stadium for the Carolina Panthers. So I think that cannot be overlooked. But the bigger point, I think, also is the power of the tourism and hospitality industry. Now, they say, with some justification, look, this is a tax on us and our businesses, although the customers are paying it. Since we are willing to have that tax on our customers, we should have it go toward our industry. And that argument seems to be winning out.
Ben, you made it sound like she was tap dancing around the issue, but we stole some audio from Flashpoint, which will air on Sunday, in which she says, quite frankly, this is a bad idea.
I believe that when you make a commitment and you tell people that you're going to use money a certain way, and they say that we're going to help you accomplish that, that we keep in our trust. And so earlier, I think that people, the thing about it, I don't think that the council members were really thinking about, well, what does this mean for the hospitality industry, as much as they were thinking, how do I get more money in Charlotte to make it possible for us to build our infrastructure, which we are really in need of. But I think that the method should be that we have to tax our people and not tax specific industries just because there's a pool of money available.
But we do need money for other things, infrastructure being one, the transit plan being another. She believes that needs to come from a different source. Is that essentially what she's saying there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about a city council who has grappled with transit and how to pay with a $13 billion transit plan for years and years and years now. So, you know, it might be tempting to look at this pot of cash from the transit, from the tourism tax and say, well, hey, can we use some of that? There's no other way through this. To pay for the mobility plan, that's $13 billion. The road goes through Raleigh. And I'm not sure they're excited about that. And they've not made a lot of headway on that, but it's still going to have to go through Raleigh. And tourism tax is not going to cut it.
I think that from what we hear from Phil Berger, that if it was a road that went through Raleigh, that they would probably give you the money, but it's a train that
goes through
Raleigh and they're not interested. Yeah. Yeah. She told you that the pot of money needed for transit has to come from a referendum.
If we get the opportunity from the legislature to have a referendum, I think it'll take a little bit more time than a year, because if we're going to ask people to do this, we need to show them what we have committed to them to accomplish. So when we look at Charlotte's needs alone, much less the needs around the towns that we're serving, then everybody needs to say, these are the things that we're going to improve and you will see a difference. I think that's the way that we have maintained trust in our community to approve these kinds of bond referendums. So I believe that along with Charlotte and the towns, people will say, we are going to do these projects. We're going to do these things for roads and we're going to do this for rail.
So there is what Eric mentioned, the keep on pounding drum for improvements to Bank of America Stadium that are looming large in the background, even though no one has said it. But there's also this concern that if we try to take money from the tourism tax and put it toward things like transit, that we're going to tick off the legislature even more than they're already ticked off, and we need them to approve this half-cent sales tax for transit. How much of a concern is that on the part of the mayor and others on council who say this is a terrible idea, Ben?
Well, keep in mind, I mean, this all comes because we had our first public meetings on the red line this week, which is like a huge deal. It's been decades in the making, and the mayor told me that she's more now optimistic about the red line than she has ever been in the past.
Well, talk to me
about it. Low bar, though, Ben. It's a low bar.
Very low bar. Yeah, very low bar, admittedly.
As you say, it's been years in the making that we've been talking about this red line. We know that the red line has to be part of the transit plan or they will not get buy-in from the northern towns in the county. Just in the last 6 months, there's been some movement on the part of Norfolk Southern to allow them to perhaps allow them to use their track for the red line. And yet they had this public meeting. And I heard earlier this week on WFAE that the whole red line is being rethought in terms of where the stops will be, et cetera.
Because here's the deal. I mean, since this first came up 20 years ago, the space, the development along the red line has completely changed. So they're having to spend millions of dollars to sort of replan this whole design to see where some of these stops could go now. They talk about one stop going in Camp North End now. But along the way, I mean, you talk about explosive growth in the northern part of the county. It's not the same real estate that it was 20 years ago. Yeah. So their whole plan is having to shift a little bit. And that's part of why the mayor said, disagreeing with what Ed Driggs said back on, I think, April 1st, of saying, hey, I'm hoping to get this on the referendum next year. And the mayor's like, there's no way that's going to happen next year.
All right, moving on. Speaking of things like taxes, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is the Republican nominee for governor in November, has spoken in the past about some financial challenges that he has experienced. But this week, ABC News reported on bankruptcy records it obtained that paint a more dire picture of his past financial and business history. What did it reveal?
Well, I went through another, as you're correct, Mike, in saying that Lieutenant Governor Robinson has talked about some of his financial struggles in the past as part of his political story. But this ABC News report went into much greater detail. Among other things, it reported that for 5 years, he and his wife did not file federal income taxes, went through the third bankruptcy that Lieutenant Governor Robinson had been through, and really drew a lot of contrasts with the statements that Robinson has made as Lieutenant Governor and as a gubernatorial candidate, things like people need to have financial responsibility or the world is, you know, essentially going to fall apart. He's made racially tinged comments about the social safety net and has just hammered away at these themes of personal responsibility and finances when even as recently as the early 2000s, according to ABC News, his assets consisted of, I think it was $40 cash and $30 savings. So you can see how this is going to cause a lot of, I guess, glee on the Democratic side, consternation on the Republican side. Robinson's spokesperson immediately said this is just recycled news that is meaningless and won't affect the campaign.
I want to ask about that, but Ben wants to talk. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, just keep in mind, this is on top of previously reported stories by WRAL in Raleigh that he didn't pay vehicle taxes for several years. And when asked about that, he sort of joked it off, saying that, you know, when it comes to taxes, I'm bad at math. So the ABC News reporting that's come out in the last 24 hours or so is on top of what's already been previous allegations about a failure to pay taxes in certain cases.
And his bankruptcy, as I understand it, centered around his wife's business, which was a daycare center. And he lost his Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection because of his failure to comply with the requirements of that plan. What about that criticism that his communications director, campaign communications director, says this is old news recycled by Democrats and their allies in the press to distract voters? Any truth to that at all? We have 30 seconds.
I think this is standard in a campaign. Things that have happened in your past are going to be brought up, so it's not a surprise.
Okay. When we come back, rent prices have gone down. I know you don't believe it, but they have. But for how long is the question? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the timeline for Brooklyn Village's development and the CMS struggle with the Parents' Bill of Rights. It's all upcoming. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's our education reporter at WFAE News. Ben Thompson is host of Flashpoint, morning anchor at WCNC-TV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. CMS was the first public school system in the state, Ann, to implement the Parents' Bill of Rights when the legislature passed it, and it prohibits instruction on gender identity, sexual activity, or sexuality in kindergarten through fourth grade, which seems reasonable, I suppose. But now records show teachers and administrators were confused about exactly what was expected of them or how to implement that plan. What else do we know, and has it been ironed out?
Well, this was the Charlotte Observer made a request for emails that were related to these conversations that were going on behind the scenes after the school board passed the policies and the administrator said, okay, let's do this. You had a lot of teachers and school staff going, well, what does this mean? And like you say, it's pretty straightforward to say we don't want explicit instruction on sexual activity in elementary school. But like one school raised a question of, well, we've got this picture book that we use for second graders about building a little free library. And in reference, in passing, it makes reference to an adult who has an ambiguous name and uses the pronoun they. And so is this instruction on gender identity? And the school district's head librarian person said, we probably should pull it, which to me is kind of bizarre. I mean, it does not say non-traditional gender identity. So if you can't even refer to a person who is non-binary, should you not refer to male or female, she and he? And somebody actually asked about if Frida Kahlo should be allowed to be featured in a lesson about arts because she's bisexual. Again, it doesn't say homosexuality. So if just being an identity, that should cover everyone. So it's kind of easy to laugh and roll your eyes at some of these things, but it tells, I think, how it feels to be a teacher in these times when if you did that, what you thought was an innocuous art lesson or the picture book about the little free library, and somebody blasted you on social media or reported you to the superintendent, you know, is it worth it?
Okay. We all know about the high price of housing here and around the country with high rents everywhere. But Ben, you have reported this week that rents dropped 2%.
That's right. You know, it will come as no shock to anybody that the apartment boom continues here in Charlotte. 14,000 new units opened last year. 30,000 units are on the way. I mean, think about it. 30,000 units are under construction here. So for that reason, for a brief amount of time, experts tell me that there is more apartments than there are renters right now. And so for that reason, there is a very small 2% drop in rent recently. After years and years of rent spiking across the city, there's a slight drop, but those same people tell me that this is going to be short-lived. So don't get too excited about it. That rent will be going back up because that gap between what's available and renters will be much closer going forward.
You spoke with Chuck McShane, who's the director of market analytics for CoStar. He told you for Flashpoint that Charlotte leads the country for apartment expansion. So right now, supply outstrips demand.
This is a short-term issue. So there's always a lag in terms of supply and demand. So 2 years ago, we were talking about a historically tight market and a historically high rent growth. So we saw in 2021 and into early 2022, rents increase as much as 15 to 20% annually. So this is the backside of that.
So if there are 30,000, I think that was the figure you threw out a second ago, apartments in the pipeline, just when will rents start to rise again?
He said it's going to happen in the short term. It's not going to be long at all. I mean, when I think about, we have all done these stories ever since the blue line went in, when all these apartment buildings started going up, and we're like, how can we possibly keep pace with this? And we've all done the stories about, well, we evidently are. We're doing just fine. So this is a brief moment, according to Chuck, that we can enjoy a drop in rent because he says in the next quarter or two, it's going to come right back up.
So one of the places where there may be more apartments forthcoming is the long-awaited Brooklyn Village development in Uptown. But that project, which has been on the drawing board for years now, may take longer still to come into being. Why, Eric?
Well, there are all kinds of reasons offered from changes in the composition of the Mecklenburg County Board of Commissioners, more time for assessing the plan, changes to the plan. I mean, it's just gone around and around and around. And we are, Mike, you said a long time. I think we're 8 years into this. This was approved in 2016. And we have a situation now where this 17-acre site, the developers closed on or bought, I think it was something like 6 acres last year, and then immediately turned around in January and put a portion of that on the market. And that kind of set off alarms because people are thinking, well, wait a minute, nothing's even really been built. We're finally seeing the developers buy some of the property and they're selling a piece of it. So the developers on the flip side say, nothing to worry about here. We will have all things in order, but this has been a delayed and troubled project for, as I said, 8 years.
Ben.
And keep in mind the historical context here. Brooklyn was a proud Black community for years and decades and decades. And then they came through, put 277 through it, completely split up the neighborhood, put a bunch of government office buildings there instead, with really no neighborhood to talk about at all. So, I mean, you have a long time coming for a real thriving neighborhood to be there. And the fact that this can't be more effectively governed is an embarrassment to a lot of people.
Phase one, which is going to have apartments plus a hotel and commercial space, is supposed to be complete by 2028. They haven't broken ground yet on it, to the best of my knowledge. Is that going to be on time? The rest of it's going to take more than a decade. So is that going to be on time, the first phase?
The developers, I think Axios reported this week, they had spoken to one of the developers who said it will be on time, that this project will be completed, and that they are as eager as anyone else to see construction begin, but that with such a large site, they're having to do the prep work to start that process. I mean, I think a lot of people really roll their eyes and gulp when they see first phase by 2028, and then the second phase doesn't have to start until 2032. Think about how much changes in business conditions and everything else in that amount of time. So I think this is going to have to be a Missouri show me state kind of thing, because so far, not a lot to show.
So we're entering the lightning round now. Short answers, because we are running quickly out of time and I have a lot of ground to cover here. You reported last week, Anne, on a charter school in Gastonia that lost its charter because of poor performance and a board that seemed semi-detached from the school's operations. And this week you report on the importance of the volunteers who act as board members at these charter schools. Why is that a problem?
Well, because when schools get in trouble, these volunteers tend to kind of go, yeah, I didn't sign up for this, and they step away, or they may not be capable of handling this. I mean, managing a school is really complicated. A lot of people think they can run a school, and a lot of them get weeded out in the application process, but even those that get in sometimes get into trouble. And this particular board that came up this time in Kinston had some really big problems, including having to pay back a lot of money.
Yeah, you reported, that's not Movement Eastland, is it? That's a different
school. No, Movement Eastland is in Charlotte. That's a whole different thing.
Okay, well, you reported on Movement Eastland, one of four schools run by the same chain. It had been put on the disciplinary status by the state and school finance office in January after reporting on potential financial troubles. But you spoke with Tim Hurley, who is Movement School's foundation director, who told you he knew nothing about any issue with the school's finances until he heard a story on WFAE, but he assured the state review board that all is well, and the board seemed to agree.
Our model is start slow and small and grow slowly, because that's what's best for our students, we believe, and that leads to early year operating deficits, and we're comfortable with that. And so, lastly, I want to assure this board, Eastland will show a positive net income for FY24, as will all of our Movement schools.
So meanwhile, going back to Kinston, the Children's Village Academy there, a charter school in eastern North Carolina, appears to be having issues involving federal grant money used for unauthorized purposes, including poorly documented loans for a board member to the school. And Stephen Gay is a member of the North Carolina Charter School Review Board.
They have a low fund balance. They have no money in the bank. They have $152,000 they have to pay, and they can't use federal funds for that.
There's no way.
When they pay that, my question going to be is, where did that money come from? Because they can't take out another loan.
You're hearing about a lot of problems at these charter schools. Are these the outliers, or is this something that should be concerning to us all?
I think they are the outliers. Certainly the majority go through this review and get approved for a renewed charter.
And finally, you reported this week that of the 12 charter schools that have been approved by the state to open in 2024, only three are ready. What's the holdup?
Buildings, basically. And it almost seems contradictory, because you're seeing this ongoing surge in charter school enrollment. When a school does open, it tends to build over several years. So this surge over the past decade or so is continuing to build. But if you are now authorized to open and you're trying to find a building, and the state doesn't write you a check for a building, so you got to get out there and find a building. So 9 out of the 12 have pulled out, and of the 3 remaining, nobody has settled into a building yet before August. One is working on a backup site because of construction delays. One will open in modular classrooms. And one that's in Union County expects to get into its building in July, a month before opening. But it's so short of enrollment that it's not totally clear that they're going to be able to open at a break-even level.
Ben, last November, we spent a lot of time discussing a violent arrest of a woman at a bus stop. Police were criticized for repeatedly hitting her during an arrest that was marijuana-related. Police say they are taking steps to modify how they use force and interact with the public. And in the aftermath of that incident, CMPD evidently received 17 reform recommendations from various groups. This week, they responded to those recommendations. What was that response?
Yeah, in these situations, they're talking about what are called de-escalation techniques. Basically, the idea here is in these sorts of situations to what they say, slow down their interaction, to let, I guess for a better term, let cooler heads prevail. Because in like that situation outside that Bojangles, where you had a woman who had marijuana at a bus stop, and then you had the video that goes viral, her hands behind her back, being roughed up. The CMPD now says in those situations, there should be more efforts focused on de-escalating what are tense situations with some of these people.
Okay. State Attorney General Josh Stein said this week that the backlog of sexual assault kits that the state has been cleared. Why was there a backup? Mary, I'll let you take a crack at that.
Sure. Yeah. So there's really been a bipartisan effort for a few years now in Raleigh to address this backlog by putting more funding into it. You know, Charlotte and Mecklenburg County in North Carolina are not alone in having this backlog. This is something that gets talked about in a lot of different places across the country, and something that was really heralded as a bipartisan accomplishment this week with getting it cleared.
So there were 11,841 kits that have finally been tested and are in the process of being tested. More than 5,000 samples, as a result, were entered into the combined DNA index system, which has DNA profiles of convicted offenders. They've gotten 2,700 matches and made 114 arrests as a result. This was, as Josh Stein said, a bipartisan effort, achievement. But he also recommended that the GOP-controlled legislature create a committee to determine how to handle these kits and prevent another backlog. Why is that the legislature's job and not law enforcement's?
So I my understanding is that a lot of it comes down to funding, right? It is not cheap to keep up with this. It is not something that, you know, it's something that, yeah, it just requires a lot of money to get it done. Obviously, as the numbers that you just said show, you know, this is not an isolated problem, and this is not something where, you know, you're dealing with a very small number of cases. This is a rampant issue in North Carolina and around the country, so it's something that takes a significant chunk of change to keep a lid on.
You might not have heard this, but there was an eclipse this week. We didn't get the full effect of it because we weren't in the path of the total eclipse, but we were close enough to see the moon cover 83% of the sun on Monday afternoon.
See it? Yeah, I see it.
It looks like a Pac-Man.
For me, it looks like a light bulb.
Kids gathered at Discovery Place, but they weren't the only ones to be awed by this celestial event. Marty Acosta, an adult who was also at Discovery Place, described the experience this way to WFAE.
It's absolutely wonderful just to think that we are living in this vast universe, and we're here on planet Earth, and we're just like a small part of the whole big puzzle. It's just amazing.
Awe-inspiring. Here's something that's not. The twin legal battles raging between the ACC, based here in Charlotte, and two member schools, Clemson and Florida State. This is so confusing. I can't even wrap my head around it, Eric. What are the twin battles?
Mike, let me just make it very simple. There are two schools, Clemson and Florida State. They want to leave the ACC because they think they can make more money in another conference. The ACC doesn't want them to leave. And if they do leave, they want them to pay a ton of money to the ACC. And so these two legal battles are playing out concurrently. How's that for an eclipse?
It's very good. But the other part of this has to do with the opaqueness of the ACC wanting to discuss how much money they're getting for the broadcast rights on ESPN, right?
That is correct. And the fun fact here, Mike, is that when member schools want to see that contract, they have to fly to Charlotte, go into the headquarters, look at the contract, And then they can't take anything with them. So it's all James Bond top secret stuff.
Wow. Okay. The bright spot in athletics this week was the women's championship game in the NCAA basketball tournament. Final matchup between undefeated USC Gamecocks and the Iowa Hawkeyes, and the remarkable Caitlin Clark won for the ages, record-setting 18.7 million viewers. South Carolina coach Dawn Staley, who finished a perfect season, 38-0, with a win in that tournament, took the time to praise Iowa's Caitlin Clark. She said she wanted to personally thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. Since you went to USC, Mary, will Caitlin be able to lift up the WNBA when she inevitably joins them?
I hope so. I think the big thing to keep in mind with all this is that this isn't new. The players have been here. The coaches have been there. The games have been amazing for decades now. What hasn't been there is the media attention and the eyeballs. So
yeah, we just discovered them. Mary Ramsey, Ann Doss Helms, Ben Thompson, Eric Spanbrick, thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.